You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. Today on the show, I'm talking with Rachel Moran, the author of Paid For, My Journey Through Prostitution. Rachel worked as a prostitute for 7 years in Ireland, finally managing to get out of the industry at 22. The book describes her experiences as well as breaks down myths and lies perpetuated by pop culture, the media, and of course the sex industry itself about prostitution, and is an incredibly powerful and brutally honest read. I spoke with Rachel over the phone from her home in Dublin. Here's that interview.
I wonder if you can start by talking about how and why you got into prostitution in the first place.
That's one of those that you could kind of put away in the space of a couple of sentences, or you could be talking about for hours. So I suppose the short way is just to state that I was homeless. I was 4 years of age when I had to leave my parents' home. Both my parents were mentally ill. My father had bipolar, as it's known today. It was a manic depression at that time, and my mother was schizophrenic, paranoid schizophrenic. So both of my parents were actually patients in the local mental hospital. And, you know, they were both, you know, one was an inpatient, one an outpatient in the local psychiatric unit. So it was very obvious, I suppose, looking back, that things were always going to be seriously problematic from the start.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about this quite a bit in your book, the argument that people make that it's safer to work indoors versus outdoors. And when you were in prostitution, you worked both indoors and outdoors. And so it seems pretty clear that there's not that the dichotomy that people pretend there is. But I wonder what your experience was like. You know, was the experience of street prostitution different than the experience of seeing John's indoors in brothels?
I think that the idea that people have that there is some kind of a difference in that outdoor prostitution is seedy and dark and dangerous, as opposed to something that goes on indoors, which is, you know, infinitely better, supposedly. I think that that's something that makes people feel comfortable and safe, and I think that it's something that they soak up from watching television shows and dramas and films and right the way down to music videos, God knows what, but wherever they're getting that information from, it's absolutely false. I worked not only indoors and outdoors, but I worked on every end of the scale, so that while I was working indoors, I worked in massage parlors, I worked in really low-end knocking shops, I made as much money as any woman in this country made in the late 90s. In the escort end of the trade. So I worked really the middle, the higher end, and everywhere on the spectrum in between. And I honestly have never, ever seen anything to convince me of anything but that the prostitution is just, it's a nightmare on every end of the spectrum. And if I actually had to go back to prostitution for one night, if I absolutely had to, I would spend the streets. And most people are very surprised when they hear that, but that is the truth.
Mm-hmm. And why do you say that? Why would you, if you had to, why would you choose the streets?
Well, first up, I suppose, if I felt I had to spend another night in prostitution, I don't think I'd want to spend another night alive at all. But if I had to spend another night in prostitution, streets are a place where you get to claim some boundaries, very minimal boundaries, tiny ones, but there are some. There is a sense on the streets of it. It is recognized that a man who's only paying you 20 or 30 or 40 euros you know, they don't have the same, they can't transgress your boundaries in the same way that a man can when he's paying you 4 or 5 times that amount of money. And that's something that I always experienced in prostitution. Even when you were in massage parlors where you might only have been paid twice what you'd be paid on the streets, the sense of violation, it increases with every euro that you're paid.
Mm-hmm. So that idea that if, you know, there was legal brothels or something like that, that idea that it would be safer or better for women working in prostitution, what do you think about that?
I actually can't express how much that disgusts me, because it's very much akin to saying, if it was legal to batter your wife, would that make it safer? If it was legal to rape women, would that somehow make it safer? It's the most appalling thing on earth. And I remember when I was 15, 16, 17, when I was in my early years in prostitution, conversations about legalization amongst the women. And I always had this nauseous sense of, oh God, no, don't anybody, you know, unionize or legalize or in any other way try to socially sanitize what's happening here. Always, always felt wrong. So wrong, because I knew it was wrong. It's just, it's something that I think if any society, you take a look at Germany, say Victoria in Australia, Nevada in the US, several other places around the globe, those countries, I believe, will be held historically to account for human rights violations against people who are mainly women, mm-hmm. as far as legalized prostitution is concerned.
Mm-hmm. You also, you wrote about using, or in your case, not using terms like call girl or escort or dancer instead of maybe what would be considered more crude words or less politically correct words today, like stripper or prostitute, or even in your words, whore. I wonder if you can talk about those words and what it is that you didn't like about those more politically correct terms.
What I didn't like about them was that they were liars. What I didn't like about them was that they were deliberately constructed in order to conceal a truth that I was living every day. Anybody who called me a call girl just would have been laughed at. Escort, laughed at. Dancer was, you know, all of these things were laughable to me. I remember meeting a young girl one time. I was actually 16 then, and she was older than me. She was 19. And she introduced herself to me as, I can't remember, was it an escort or a call girl or something like that? And I said to her, hi, good for you. I'm a whore myself, you know. And I remember meeting her in the eye, and, I greeted several people like that around that time. But I remember that particular girl because I remember the eye-popping surprise. She just couldn't believe what she was hearing. Somebody was actually saying that, you know, and because these were the terms that we were supposed to cover up and shy away from and brush under the carpet, you know. And I hated what I was doing. I hated every moment of it. But I absolutely despised lying about it. I couldn't do that. And I couldn't tolerate anyone else doing it in my company either.
Mm-hmm. You wrote that most prostitutes are from backgrounds of dysfunction. And you talked about reasons why women who came even from relative privilege would go into prostitution. I wonder what you learned about prostituted women and their backgrounds during your time in the industry.
Well, first of all, what I said in my book was that, you know, the majority of women were from dysfunctional backgrounds. Yeah, that's very true. But what I'd like people to understand is that, first of all, dysfunction crosses the entire social spectrum, and that is a fact. And it's not a fact that I was aware of, actually, in my early teens. I literally didn't realize that when I became homeless and when I spent about 18 months in and out of the residential care system. I was under the mistaken illusion that the only people who came from dysfunctional backgrounds were people like myself who were, you know, lower working class families. I'm not sure what the term is in the United States and Canada, but over here we would say, you know, lower working class. You know, and I thought that that's where dysfunction began and ended. I was very wrong. Generally, the women in prostitution, and girls, I should say, because they were usually girls when they first went in, generally they were from the lower socioeconomic classes. But the women that I met who would have been relatively privileged, and they were few and far between, by the way, but the women I met in that social position, they had very obvious dysfunction going on with them. I mean, I'm talking about women who had scars on their wrists, women who were very obviously psychologically disturbed, women who would behave in ways that could only communicate that there was something wrong. You know, the hardcore cocaine addicts, I mean, just women who were having like 3-4 affairs in the middle, you know, every type of dysfunction you can think of, women from broken homes. There was a never-ending, just endless array of social, you know, familial problems. It never stopped.
Mm-hmm. I know that some people think that we shouldn't... It's interesting because it seems like a kind of popular position to take in certain sections of feminism or third wave feminism, I guess, or sometimes they call themselves sex positive feminists. They think that we shouldn't vilify Johns or talk about Johns or, you know, say that men who buy sex are bad men or are misogynist. You know, they don't want us to generalize in that way. And you wrote that men always violate in prostitution. What does that mean? You know, I mean, are there nice Johns?
I guess that depends on how you classify a nice man. Yeah. Are there nice Johns? The whole sex positive thing, first of all, I have to tell you, really, really gets under my skin. It pisses me off. I need to be direct about that. Mm-hmm. Because if you are sex positive, in other words, I mean, so if you are positive about sex, well, then you're not going to be positive about sexual exploitation. Mm-hmm. Sex is something that's within us and all around us and something that we should be able to flow in and out of and enjoy for ourselves and with each other. That does not happen in prostitution. It's not in prostitution. Prostitution is an area of life where sex is so polluted and contorted and wholly introverted. It's beyond disgusting. It is quite simply wrongdoing. And what bothers me is when people try to pretend that morality doesn't deserve to have a look in here. Morality absolutely deserves to have a look in here. Because, yes, and I will say it out loud and proud, this is morally wrong for the simple fact that it is damaging. That's what makes it morally wrong. People say, let's remove morality from this issue. Morality has no right to even have a look in it. That is some nonsense. And whoever's saying that, let them walk into a brothel and find their 16-year-old girl sitting on that brothel's bed and tell me morality doesn't deserve to have a look in here.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about what you said, that men always violate in prostitution. What does that mean?
They always violate. It's not possible for a man to reduce a woman's body to the status of a commodity without violating her humanity. For me, that is very clear. It's very simple. It's clear because I've lived it, because I felt it, because I know what it means to be reduced to the status of a commodity. I know exactly what that does to your psyche. I know how it feels in your body and how that relates to what's going on in your heart and mind. And if you're any way wired upright, you will know what's wrong because you will feel it as it's happening. Now, you may not be wired upright, mm-hmm. okay? So this is where we enter the women who say that there's absolutely nothing wrong with the way that they're abused every day. Mm-hmm. I feel sorry for those women. By God, I feel a lot sorrier for those women than I feel for the women I know who are dealing with the reality of the abusive nature of the prostitution that they lived every day.
Mm-hmm. You also wrote about men who get off on evil acts, or as you put it, you wrote about how sexuality could be a source of evil. And people tend to like to think about sex and sexuality. This ties into the sex positive thing you talked about earlier. People tend to like to think about sex and sexuality as only good, or at very least, you know, something private, meaning that they separate sex and sexuality from the world around them and from outside influences. And they say that fantasies are not reality, often in defense of things like pornography and S&M and things like that. I wonder if you can talk about that evil arousal you referred to and how that's related to men and male sexuality, and specifically to men who buy sex.
Oh, God, that's a really big issue, Megan. I could sit down and write a few chapters about that one. There certainly is an evil arousal. There's no two ways about that. I've seen it. I've had it enacted on my body. I've known women. I've witnessed women have it enacted on their bodies, and I've seen the impact of it in their lives and my own. An evil arousal is anything that causes a person to forego the humanity of the person that they're enacting their fantasy upon, or forego humanity generally in order to get off, okay? So you don't need to involve any other person. I mean, you might be just sitting at home on your own, jacking off, watching a porn video. Does anybody seriously think that when they're looking at the image of pornography on a screen, that they're looking at anything less than documentary evidence of sexual abuse? Because that's what pornography is. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely what pornography is. And anybody who wants to say otherwise just needs to superimpose the face of their own sister or daughter or wife or mother on the face of the female porn actress on that screen. And if they can do that and tell me that there's nothing wrong with that, I'm not going to say, okay, that's fine, I agree with you. I'm going to say, go and see your doctor, love, there's something wrong with you. Mm-hmm. It's a really, really big area, Megan, that I could talk about for a long time. But what I will say is that there's something very sick going on in society today, and has been now for God knows, but certainly in the last few decades since pornography has really taken hold, since the 70s, we're on a very deep downhill slide as far as where we are allowing our own sexual indulgences to take us as a species, basically. I read something not too long ago. It was by the English author C.S. And he had made the point that there was something very, very sick about anybody who would walk into a restaurant, okay, and sit around salivating, just observing the food and allowing themselves to become transfixed and water-mouthed and, you know, gasping just to observe and taste this food in every sensory level except with their mouths. And he made that point because he was making the comparison with the way that people indulge in pornography in order to satisfy their sexuality. And his point was that there's something seriously up. If you're going to sit around looking and admiring and observing a meal all day, there's something up with you. He was talking about pornography, strip bars, all that end of the sex industry. And I think that he was absolutely right. There's something that should be very clearly sick about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also thought that what you wrote about sexual abuse and prostitution was quite powerful. And you said, this is a quote, "What you are actually doing when you prostitute yourself is sanctioning and accepting payment for the sexual abuse of your own body." And it, again, it isn't popular to talk about prostitution as rape or abuse these days. It's preferable to talk about things like women's agency, or to talk about prostitution as simply a service or as a job, something that women choose to do, maybe because they enjoy it. And I wonder if you can talk about, you know, that idea, prostitution as sexual abuse, or that reality, rather. It's not an idea, it's a reality. And that statement that you're sanctioning and accepting payment for the sexual abuse of your own bodies. You know, why do you think so many women who identify as sex workers publicly are unwilling to call their experience abuse?
Well, that's very simple. If women who publicly identify as sex workers, which is a nonsense term in itself, by the way, but if they were to identify what's happening to them every day as abuse, well, then they would be running against their own control fantasy. It's very important for women in prostitution to pretend, as it was for me to pretend, that I had some measure of control. You know, you have to hold on to that notion. You have to hold on to that idea. For the simple fact that you know the reality is that you have no control. When you're in prostitution, you know that. And you can't let go of this idea that you have some control. I mean, it's dangerous, besides anything else, to do that on a whole lot of different levels. One of them, the most important one, I reckon, would be psychological. But getting back to the idea that, you know, this is not sexual abuse, you know, that this is some kind of service. The problem with the way that the world is set up today, we are living underneath a couple of different really powerful structures, and one of them is capitalism. And people have this notion that there's no such thing as paid abuse. So as soon as money enters the equation, whatever's happening cannot be abusive. But only if it involves sex, you see, and this is the strange thing. Because if a person, be they male or female, should work in some type of an environment that induces great boredom or stress, or, you know, let's say they're in a bullying environment, or, you know, all of these things are recognized. They're recognized as harmful aspects that happen in capitalism. But sexual abuse, people reckon, just cannot be paid for. You know, sexual abuse is something that it's either sexual abuse or it's not. And as soon as money enters the equation, well, then that erases the sexually abusive nature of what's going on. And I think that that's something people really need to look at, because that is some nonsense right there. Something is either abusive or it's not. And you cannot pay. There is no currency on this earth that can take away the sexually abusive nature of what happens, either in prostitution or anywhere else. You simply cannot buy that away. Can't happen.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, how did you cope when you were in the industry? I mean, obviously, it was awful and traumatic. I wonder if you had coping mechanisms or survival strategies.
Well, we all had those. To be honest with you, I think I was politically aware to an extent that made what I was living probably a bit more difficult for me. It was difficult for all of us, don't get me wrong, but most of the women, myself included, smothered what was happening to us under layers of drug abuse, denial, you know, all sorts of different coping strategies. But there was always a part of me that was absolutely and acutely aware of the nature of what was happening and the politics of what was going on. And I mightn't have been very, very sharp with the politics, you know, as a teenager. I was in prostitution from I was 15 till I was 22. So I mightn't have been able to verbalize for you exactly what was happening, but I absolutely could have shared how I felt about it. And I knew that it was a male versus female power struggle. I knew that it was something that was very, very painful for me, and something that I wouldn't have been living had I not been a homeless young girl. So I had that kind of rudimentary sense of the politics, and that made things very, very difficult for me. I absolutely hated every moment of it. I always did, and I always swore that I would come back and write about it, because I was not walking away from that and just letting that one go. No way.
Mm-hmm. And how did you eventually leave the industry, and why?
Well, I left simply because I couldn't stay. If I had stayed, I think I would have either, I don't know, had a nervous breakdown, or, you know, died of a drug overdose, or something like that was waiting down the line for me. I left in 1998. I was 22 at the time. I was about 3.5-4 years deep into a cocaine addiction, very serious addiction. I was in a really, really bad way at the end of that time. And my son was 4.5. He was just about to start school. I got out of prostitution in August of 98, so it's actually my 15th year anniversary, thank God, out of prostitution. I just had to bundle myself and my child up and get out of there and move to the next county and spend some time. I was there about 10 months trying to find a way back to living, drug-free, out of prostitution. It was a hard time.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I wonder what the process of writing this book was like. I assume it was very difficult, but I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit.
I started writing the book in 2002. I was about 3.5 years or so out of prostitution at the time, and I just started to write it just simply because I had to. I needed to forge the past. I needed to get what had happened out of my system, but at the same time, I also needed to create a sense of awareness. I needed to make people aware of what had happened to me and so many other young girls, and why, what I had seen, what it meant to me emotionally, politically, from a feminist perspective. And it took a long, long time. I spent 11 years writing that book. It took a long time because it wasn't something I sat down and did every day. I would write maybe a couple of paragraphs or a couple of pages, and I would leave it alone for a few weeks. And I came and went from it like that for a very long period of time because it was extraordinarily painful. And I started to step it up in the last couple of years as I, you know, I'd spent a few years in therapy, and I started to get some strength about myself. And, you know, it was strange because I was invited to the launch of the Turn Off the Red Light campaign, which is a coalition of 70 different organizations here in Ireland who are all calling for the implementation of the Nordic model. And I was invited to that talk in February of 2011. And it was an extraordinary coincidence because that's just as I was coming up on the end, the final years of writing the book. So I actually signed the book deal in the late spring of the following year, 2012. So it was the way it all came together. I felt it was meant to be. I'm sure it was.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations on the book. It's really amazing, and I can't recommend it enough. I thought it was so powerful and so well written, and I'm so grateful that you wrote it.
Thanks so much, Megan.
And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You just heard an interview with Rachel Moran, the author of Paid For, My Journey Through Prostitution. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.